So then life is different then, isn't it? The life of a frog is different from the life of a tadpole. You know, when a frog develops and gets up onto the shore, then it's never the same again, is it? Life is never the same again. It can come in and out. Knows when it knows it's in the water, knows it's out of the water, knows that there's something out of the water when it's in the water. But when it's a tadpole, it knew nothing about life on the shore. Or a butterfly or something, or existence of a caterpillar, totally different, isn't it? This is the kind of transformation that one can go through if one is very dedicated and practices for very many, many years, or lifetimes even. Then one can go through these this incredible transformation of mind and find a whole new world in addition to the other one. So not excluding the old one, but a whole lot of new things, new aspects, and so we have to be able to then open up our view or model of the mind. So when I was first in Thailand, you know, I went there with, there was me with my, you know, degree in psychology, being a psychologist, and had to some degree begun to open up this view and realise that it was a limited view. And then I went to see a great meditation master, and you know, I'd gone a long way, and I was quite feeling anxious that, you know, was this man the great master that I thought he was? I was sitting there, I was massaging him one evening, it was very soon after my arrival, and I was thinking to myself, well, is he really the great meditator that they say he is? And as soon as I'd thought this, then this great master turned to the monk next to him, and he said in Thai to this man to translate, he said, "Well, please tell Kalyano that I don't lose my mindfulness when I talk to the lay people." So I thought, well, how is he the great meditation master? I thought he was. I always see him talking to the lay people, I'd thought. So I forgot that bit, didn't I? Yeah, so he directly answered my thought, just like I'd said something, just like I'd asked him a question, just like I said to him, "Ajahn, I see you talking to the lay people a lot, and yet I have this image in my mind of you as this great meditation master. I'm concerned that," if I'd said that, he just turned to me and reassured me, "Well, don't worry, you know, I don't lose my mindfulness when I talk to the lay people," reassuring me. So to me that was too great a coincidence, enough for me then not to believe that this man could read my mind. I don't know any psychologist who can understand that, explain that in psychological terms. For me it was another opening up of my world. Not to make too much of that particular experience just in and of itself. What was important was just a sense of dropping my preconceptions about what the mind is. This can be very important. Be able to open ourselves up to new experiences. It partly perhaps not our inadequacy, but our lack of openness, our lack of openness to new possibilities that closes us to such experiences, or just the way we interpret experience. So having lived with Thai monks for periods of time, then you realise that if a Thai monk were to have a kind of wave of joy that seems to come from nowhere, for example, you know, I was on this monk with arms around once, and he had this wave of joy that just seemed to come from nowhere as the people were offering him food, his food for the day. And afterwards he said, "Oh, it was marvellous, this deva visited me on the arms round. I had this lovely wave of joy that came from nowhere." instead of being Thai, then he would interpret it like that. And being a Westerner, you know, I was on the same arms round. Yes, it was a beautiful experience. I experienced a lot of joy. Everybody turned out. It was the most inspiring experience. There were about 200 monks on the arms round, and you know, the whole town turned out. It was overwhelming, the sense of faith and support and love. So I had a lot of joy, but I didn't think that a deva had visited me. Maybe this is just a different way in which we're interpreting experience rather than a different experience. It's possible, isn't it? So there's always, these would all be examples, little examples of waking up. If we wake up a little bit, then we have to open up the mind to a new model of operating. We say these experiences are things that can help us to wake up. And wake up to something bigger. A bigger mind, a bigger mind in which the mind isn't in the body. I don't know, I get the sense of a mind trapped in the body, but the body is in the mind. So I often point at this as a crucial step in realigning our existential understanding of ourselves. If we realise that the mind's not in the body, the body is in the mind. If the mind goes into the body, then this is feeling. What we experience is feeling. And this is what happens when the kind of mind and body overlap with each other. You get feeling. It's like the mind touching the body, isn't it? You have feeling. You only realise that if the mind is let go of the body. Mind's let go of the body, then you know that yes, there's letting go of the body, and then there's touching the body. Touching the body elicits this kind of physical, mental feelings. Letting go of the body, then you experience these wonderful, blissful, open spiritual feelings. Different kind of feeling, much more pleasant. So one's not particularly averse or wanting to get away from the body, but they're keen to let go of it. Open up around it. I'm keen to have one to let go of. The state of detachment from the body, of letting go of the body, in the presence of the body, not so it disappears, is the most pleasant. It's a wonderful feeling. This is the mind expanding, which is what happens when we wake up, isn't it? The mind opens. So it can be that we can confuse, that if we just overcome our sloth and torpor, you know, we're just more awake than usual, we feel particularly wide awake, and then we could confuse that with something deeper. It's possible for people to do that, but it's a kind of opening of the heart, which is something that we would never have experienced before. It's new ground. This can be difficult because then, if this is the case, then there are two kinds of people in the spiritual world. There are people who've had these kinds of experiences, and then there's people who haven't. And there's no way around that. And we have to manage that somehow or another. We can't all be the same anymore, which is can be a comfortable way to be. It's for everyone to be the same, and yet this experience is mean that some people aren't the same as others. Some people have had some kind of transformative experience. So we have to try and find a way of including that in all our social understanding of things, particularly in a culture that doesn't recognise these things very easily or know much about them. So a lot of strange things can happen around this, misunderstandings and fears, jealousies and all kinds of things. So even when one just cultivates a degree of mindfulness, the mind's bright. And if this brightness shows in the eyes, which it doesn't always, incidentally, it shows in different ways, different times, then this can cause confusion in social circles where this isn't recognised. So even if you were to, if you do a meditation retreat and you come out all bright-eyed, you get on a bus, those kind of things happen to me, then I was on a train once and I was packed up, an underground train, I was packed up against two people, a young woman, pretty young woman, and a big black guy. And my mum is quite bright, had just been on a meditation retreat, quite a long one, so I just caught the eye of this young woman, and this young woman immediately interpreted my look, at least this is what it seemed to immediately interpret my look as desire. And she was sparkling back at me. Oh, a bit of excitement. Looked at this big black guy and immediately felt threatened. Like the strength in my eye was aggression. Same look. If that look is sustained, then often people will get the idea. They realise that if it's steady, the light is steady, and then it's somehow different. So it's not just a leap of excitement or a leap of aggression, it's something steady. So momentary misunderstandings or mistakes or things can happen to us, isn't it? So people are not seeing a mind state that they don't know themselves for themselves. A skillful way of relating to this is that somebody has managed to develop some of this. One, they've had to work very hard, so you can admire these people, admire people for having worked so hard. But the other thing is that we can see that they've had some good luck and good privilege and in life. They've been lucky to find the right conditions. Maybe they have the good karma. They created the good karma in the past to be able to find themselves the right conditions, or they've taken risks, they've gone off into secluded places, or had to give up a lot in order to find this kind of thing. So in my eyes, people like this can command an enormous amount of respect. And they can really help us. They help us to wake up instead of analysing the dream. Which would be fruitless, isn't it, if you can wake up. It's fruitless, it's all gone, isn't it? The dreams have all gone. Disappeared. In the normal waking state, they haven't quite all disappeared, but there is a state in which they all disappear. This is a way in which the psychologists and the therapists will write in a way that maybe these states, the dream states, don't completely disappear. We're always a little bit asleep, and these things are kind of influencing us in a mysterious way. It's kind of about right, really. But if we can wake up, then this has to be the priority, isn't it? So I'd advise strongly advise you to wake up rather than analysing the dream. I offer that for your reflection.